This is Bellamy, and before we begin today's show, I just want to put a request, offer sort of deal out there. If anyone wants to help us improve our crappy website that you might have noticed continues to be crappy weeks and weeks after it's been made, we would really appreciate it and might even be tempted to throw some other incentives your way, such as the singular opportunity to have Ryder and Bellamy as your bosses because they're too lazy to do the work themselves and probably too incompetent as well, like most bosses.
Welcome to Free Radical Radio. It is episode 78. We're gently climbing that hill toward 100, at which point I imagine
actually, at 100.
I thought there was going to be some sort of millenarian absolution. We would ascend to, I don't know, some kind of higher anarchist form. Anarch? Will we achieve that?
I think that civilization, we always believe, would end at episode 100. So if you're listening out there, you're only 22 weeks or 22 episodes, whatever comes first, probably weeks, away from true anarchy.
If you haven't been working on your primitive skills, your ability toward mutual aid, you should really start working on that now. You have 22 weeks before we...
We've actually come under some fire for our lack of primitivist skills.
Oh.
Although I'm actually pretty proficient with a bow at this point in time, I feel like.
Natural born killer.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm just a natural born talker.
I mean, I basically boiled down human and anarchist existence to fucking killing and eating. Mm. So I don't know why people make it more complicated than that.
Yeah. Some of us prefer paragraphs of frothing.
Yeah.
As a high-level Free Radical Radio fan and great friend of the show put it recently.
Oh, yeah. Well, all right. Let's just jump into things. So last week I was at the reading group I go to, and I ran into a great, great situation. I was more or less trying to just make the point that at some time in human history, people decided that they were willing to be slaves because the only reason for slavery to exist means someone has to accept that they will be a slave because you can kill yourself or you can fight to the death or whatever. I wasn't making a positive or negative. I was just saying at some point this thing happened.
Someone told me recently that Renzo Novatore's son, who I didn't know, I guess, wrote things about anarchy as well. Oh. Maybe you knew this.
No, I didn't know that.
He's a poet.
Yeah.
And he's credited with the phrase, obedience is the mother of command. Obedience is the mother of command. So in other words, obedience came first.
Yeah, well, this is the Sam Delaney point that I want to get to. We'll hopefully get to next week in a Wingnut confessional segment, which is that, it's like the chicken or the egg, the slave and the master. Is there a difference? Is anyone really one and not the other? And it's just a binary that kind of exists, and it doesn't really matter which side. Obviously, it matters which side you're on, but in terms of its creation. Yeah. So anyways, so I was talking about this, and I was just, I mean, obviously I think slavery is bad. As much as anything can be bad, that seems like a bad thing to me. I'm not a huge fan of slavery. I feel fairly confident saying that. And I found myself in a room where this was not quite a popular opinion. So I was just saying, about the Egyptian pyramids, and I was talking like, and as I brought that up as a specific example of, maybe this doesn't seem so great. And I was just trying to talk about the idea that many animals will kill themselves in captivity, and more so than that, they just won't breed, like the panda. They just won't breed in captivity, and animals refuse to persist their existence when presented with a slavery-like situation. Human beings are not like that. We've lived under slavery for the better part of 10,000 years now, from chattel form to wage slavery form to the varying different forms of slavery that one exists in, whether it's like gender slavery or being married to someone and being forced, unable to get divorced. And certain societies and religions, there's varying degrees, obviously, of how shitty that is. So anyways, I brought this up and someone, looked at me and they were very pissed off. They were super bitter about this. And they said, you don't know what the spiritual experience of the Egyptians were when they were building the pyramid. You don't know what it's like to be part of a culture working to build something special together.
Yeah. So my question then would be, what is it that they are building? I would say it's a monument to authority, the pharaoh. It's a monument to deferred pleasure, since that was a culture that was obsessed with the afterlife, right? That at certain points... during that culture's development, there was such a focus on death that life was just seen as this kind of burden that you had to get through in order to achieve the afterlife. And depending on how you were and how you behaved, your treatment in the afterlife would be, you know, they had to, what was it? They weighed the soul against something else, the scales. Anubis had the scales, and they weigh the soul against something else. And then depending on how your soul weighs.
I haven't seen Stargate in a long time.
You might, well, depending on how your soul weighs, you might get eaten by one of the deific creatures, or you might get delivered into Osiris's kingdom. And
that's the good place to be.
That's the good place.
All right. Yeah. What up, Osiris?
But and so then how did that person take that?
Not well. It turned into like a very disagreeable thing where they went into the most extreme version of cultural relativism, saying you don't know what someone else's experience is like.
Well, sure. That, I mean, that's fine. I think that you can hold that and say, you're right, I don't know what it was.
Sure. But I can also say I'm probably not interested in it. I can guess that even if I was part of that culture, I might not want to be built. And then a friend of mine, just looked at them and said, you know, you don't realize... Sometimes if you're closest to the peg, you don't realize you're a slave, which, you know, they were just saying, like, there's ways that you can be accustomed to something and not realize it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you can hold that you don't know what that person's experience was. And I think you can even hold that a person in a place of servitude, whatever it is, might feel quite comfortable with it and might not actively want to be out of that situation and still maintain that they're being cut off from a deeper, richer, more passionate experience of life. I mean, I think there are... I mean, look at the hikikomori situation in Japan, right? I mean, I'm sure some of the people who are experiencing that do actively feel depressed and maybe don't like their situation and don't have the energy or the emotional vigor to escape from it, but I'm sure some of them, I'm not going to hazard any guesses at which portion is which, I'm sure some of them say, no, this is what I want. It's nice. I don't want to leave my room. I don't want to deal with people. I prefer online life. And you know, I think someone could say, Bellamy, you don't know what that experience is like for that person. You're right, because I enjoy going out into the world, but I can still look at them and say, that person's in a shitty spot, and I would like to see them emancipated from it.
Yeah, and then so the person looking at me and just being like, "You have opinions and I have perspectives," and I'm just like, "Okay, like now we're gonna play the semantics game. Like, do you want me to dictionary.com like perspectives and opinions to figure out what you're saying, or you're actually gonna say something meaningful to me?" And it's like this thing that always happens: people just stop engaging and they want to use fucking bullshit jargon. Like, "Oh, you have an opinion, I have a perspective. How about you just actually talk about the thing we're talking about?" Because we're engaging what this situation is like, and that you believe this is a spiritual experience. I'm assuming because you have some type of religious bullshit that like lets you go through your day better, living in this world, because you can't do it as a nihilist or you can't do it as you know, whatever else, and you're choosing to believe that you don't know anyone else's spiritual experience, which alleviates you from the guilt that one would normally feel in a way that is bullshit, to be honest.
Yeah, and my question is, why are you drawing sacred lines that critique can't cross? Why can't we critique in a way that, as I was saying, acknowledges that we don't know what it's like to be anyone except for us, and... You know, we
don't even know what it's like to be ourselves most of the time. Like, can I describe my experience to you in a way that you'll understand? Never. Do I even understand it? No. I keep making decisions that seemingly don't benefit me constantly. My whole body's in pain right now. I don't know why. It's probably because I have some illness that I haven't gone to see the doctor for. I've been woken up like 4 days in a row with my feet feel like someone's jackhammering them.
Yeah. Why didn't you pay all those parking tickets and let it get to the point that it seriously disrupted your life because they put a club on your car?
I did.
I don't know the club.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think you know either.
I don't know either. You know, why do I date people for years that are terrible to me? Who knows?
Well, we can make some inferences there.
Yeah, well, you can make guesses, but like I keep doing it, you know.
But yeah, so why draw these lines that we can't cross? Why can't we put critique out there that acknowledges that there are weaknesses in the critique? We don't know what people's experiences are. We can only make inferences as to what the past... I mean, we're talking about a kingdom that existed ages and ages ago. Sure, we don't know exactly what was going on, but we can make inferences, and those inferences can inform our lives, and those inferences can be falsified when new evidence comes to the fore. But I don't think the fact that a critique might be mistaken, which surely almost every critique that has ever been advanced has... is a reason not to advance it.
Yeah, there's a really good quote that a Delaney book, Tales of Neveronia, opens up with, and it's basically saying that, like, most everything we've ever thought has been just totally wrong, and almost every idea and theory ends up being completely proven wrong. However, the richness is in just having the idea and exploring it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but some people don't want you to explore ideas.
No.
They're not interested.
They want to draw boundaries and say you're fucked up.
Yeah. They think all explorers are going to Columbus the exploring experience.
Goodness. Wow.
And there's many ways to do the exploring experience.
Wow.
You know? Peter Lamborn Wilson is a big person who explores things. Many people explore things in different ways. Some people don't like the way he explores things.
Goodness.
Which is, we're not going to go down that road, because that can be a potentially dark road, and we probably have enough controversy without going down that road.
Yeah, I'm not sure those first steps you took. I'm not sure what you were aiming at. But, it's time for the Rydra ambush accountability process.
Oh, well, you want to do that now or later? Go ahead.
You're trying to delay your accountability process? It's pretty fucked up.
Well, the problem is, if I don't even know myself, how can I be accountable to myself or anyone else? This is the problem I have. Who am I? What am I? Where am I? Why am I? I have no good answers to any of these things.
If you're born and you die in each moment, then how can you ever be accountable? So, the first thing, because there's a internet chatter that was interesting to me, Rydra, are you an egoist? Or do you just silently go along with... You don't actively oppose things that I say on the air.
I mean, I have interest in egoism. I like the writing of egoist people, but I would probably not go as far as currently to call myself an egoist in this particular moment. I'm not so sure how I feel about the self. I have some ideas of community. I'm back and forth on these things. Can a human being exist independent of other people?
This
I'm not,
is not
sure.
This is... I don't disagree with you there.
So there we go.
Okay.
We have agreed and put the baby to bed.
I'm not sure what you mean, and so I'm just going to move on from this. I just wanted to clear up, just because I talk about egoism and Rydra doesn't actively disagree with me does not mean that he agrees with everything that I'm saying, nor do I agree with many things that he says.
Although I just want to let you say that I think people that don't agree with me are usually idiots. That's my general take on people who don't agree with me.
Active hostility.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is, Rydra, you stirred up some emotions with your talk about anarchy as a struggle last week, and some people, I think, interpreted you as saying that resistance is pointless, that we might as well just hang out with our friends, that mass movements
taken.
Are the same thing as sabotage, and as far as being equally useless, or the same thing as assassination as far as the impotence and pointlessness. How do you feel about that?
I think I got a little carried away on one of my rants, and I just want to say, as someone who's made their opinions about things like wild reaction known, that now I'm trying not to say quite, trying to phrase things a little differently for personal safety and enjoying being in my decent-sized cage.
Well, it's funny because it's all recorded and widely distributed on the internet.
Well, no, semi-widely. But anyways, besides the point, I do have more interest in things like... the things that we talk about that are more violent actions, one might say. I have more interest in these types of things than obviously mass movement things. And I was just more trying to point out that, like, I'm pessimistic that these things will work.
Pessimism.
Yeah. I mean, but I think pessimism is a thing that gets mistaken often. I'm pessimistic about mass movements and revolution because I have seen and have read and... about many different types of mass movements and many different types of revolutions, and I have never seen any of them produce anything I would want to live in. So I feel like it's very reasonable to be pessimistic about that. I also have seen the same thing with assassination. It's not a new thing. However, I don't mind that people strike fear into the hearts of assholes like nuclear scientists and nanotechnology people and, you know, whoever else you want to throw into that whole grouping. I find these to be interesting things.
So one thing I felt I heard you saying was that the mass movement for the 8-hour day ultimately was a failure because it was gradually erased through, changes in production that people started to get things like having to have a second job that were get a lot of unclocked off or what? Sorry, work off the clock.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hidden work off the clock.
There is.
And because real wages have been falling as cost of living goes higher while wages stay mostly the same.
And rages.
Wages stay mostly the same. That gradually the whatever gains this mass movement had were eroded.
Yeah, plus I hesitate to call them gains. Like, what are these gains? Like it, the gain is that people get to vote in this thing. Like, I get to vote. Like, if other people, like, you know, felons can't vote in many places right now. If felons got the right to vote, am I going to be like, oh, look at you. You're really doing great. Now you get the thing I have, which I don't even fucking do because I think it's stupid. Like, should they have options? I don't know. Like, that doesn't seem like much of an option to me. Like, that it doesn't improve quality of life. It doesn't change anything. I don't see any difference in this. So I think people just keep fighting for these. Like, I keep seeing this person online posting, like, get rid of the box. Sure, like, I agree, ban the box. It's obviously an extremely difficult thing to get a job as a felon, but jobs fucking suck. And it's this battle between trying to reform things and trying to actually make something different, because reforming something isn't changing it. It's just making something better. So making it so that techno-industrial civilization can keep going further and further because people, which we're going to talk about this later in more detail, because people are then able to believe the myth of progress. They're able to, oh, look, fucking gays can marry now. Like, congratulations. Like, who gives a fuck about marrying? It's like, I mean, it's just one of so many different issues that fall under the mass movement banner, that fall under, you know, an anarchist write all this. And at the end of the day, what the liberal or leftist anarchist or mass movement anarchist says is, if they're actually an anarchist, what they'll say is, you know, marriage equality is not something I'm going to fight for because I don't believe in marriage, but I'm glad other people are doing it. And it's this kind of like accepting of different tactics and like trying to say that these like liberal non-property types are on the same, somehow the same team as you, where it's, and you just include all these people and it's like, magically, I have affinity with millions of people. I don't have affinity with millions of people. I don't even know if there's 10 people I have affinity with. I have affinity with very few people. Like, this is why, like, things like anarcho-primitivism have more interest to me, because I do think that the only way for humans to actually get along with each other and for me to exist in any type of community that I enjoy, it would have to be very small. It couldn't even have 5,000 people. A lot of people talk about things like that and have democracy and federations and all this, and I just, like, shake my head and stab myself or something.
Well, that last part hasn't happened yet, but maybe you're pessimistic about achieving that as well. But just to be clear, the pessimism that you feel, how would you describe the pessimism you just described toward mass movements comparing to that of an action like Nicola Guy and Alfredo Caspita?
Well, at least it feels better to have things I don't like aesthetically not exist anymore. So, or have pain caused to things I don't like. It's more direct. I prefer a more direct approach to things in general. I feel like mass movement is probably like the most indirect thing. It's like, let's get together 20 million of our friends and all change things together in our beautiful diaspora of different ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about something Nicola Guy wrote later, so you'll be able to hear more about what Rydra thinks and also some things that I think.
All right. Well,
so
you want to get into this?
Yeah. Right. So
I can bring us into this. So,
okay.
So thanks, John, for, I said, you're
trying to think about whether to
say
someone's
name. I said like their name that no one calls them. Like, they usually people say the different version of their name. So anyway, they'll know who it is. Thanks for emailing us this article. You know who you are. Friend of ours. And anyways, so if you're wondering if there's like, you know, all these laws have been happening in Spain, these real people keep calling them draconian, you can't be on the streets, you can't protest, like they've really taken a fucking knife and dug into the heart of the mass movement. You can't do the spectacular protest anymore. So what do they say? What does the mass movement say? Fuck you, we'll become way more spectacular. And a beautiful slogan, which my Spanish is going to really come in handy here, the Hologramas para la libertad has arisen in Spain, which So it's holograms for freedom, basically. And this is a response to these laws. And what they're doing is they projected holograms into the streets of, I think, Barcelona. I'm not sure which city. Somewhere in Spain. And had a hologram protest. So they asked people to submit holograms to them. So this is literally people looking at their computer, like raising a fist saying, fuck you, state, I don't like you, and sending their hologram. And I don't like you so much that I'm going to fucking hologram your ass.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. There's You should read the line, and then I want to say something.
Well, I'm gonna read the two best lines. I'll read the first one. This is what one of the people, a woman from the video, there's a long video, this is what she said. She said, "If you are a person, you cannot express yourself freely. You can only do that here if you become a hologram." And then here's another gem from another person in the video. They said, "As we can't protest as free citizens, we protest as free holograms."
The hologram being free from many laws, the law of gravity, the hologram being immune to tear gas and rubber bullets. The hologram, in many ways, more free than the human being. Yeah.
Well, I just think it's funny because, like, they're so quick to accept it. It's like, well, I guess I'm not a free citizen anymore. Like, you never were. Here's the secret. But, now I'm just a free hologram, and I've totally accepted it, and I'm on board. It's not like I'm going to fight this and try to be a free citizen. I'm like, set my hologram free. You know, come on.
Yeah.
This is some wild bullshit.
Yeah, so now I guess many police will record themselves, you know, waving clubs at people. And
are the police sending videos of, like, them brutalizing people, like imaginary people, and they're going to battle in hologram fashion, and we can just keep the spectacular spectacle just even more spectacularly spectacly?
Yeah, frightening. I mean, you see a major part of the civil disobedience paradigm is that you cross the lines that are laid out for you just very lightly in order to show the unjustness of the line. So I guess now we see that when the state draws the lines more tightly, then rather than crossing the line that used to exist, you modify your behavior to cross the new line just very lightly wherever they've set it. And I think the poverty of the civil disobedience paradigm is shown here, that it's always a reactive position. You're always defining yourself in terms of what the adversary lays out for you. And so here we see that as the space gets smaller and smaller, so does the resistance.
Well, this is just like the mass movement things. They just want things to be a little bit better. No matter how bad the state makes things or society makes things, they're just going to make it a little bit better. So they've already accepted that they're not going to be a free person. So now they just want a free hologram. And they've given up on the idea of a person and being out in the streets. There's no need to fight these laws now. Instead, they're just going to go out and fucking put video game versions of themselves, like, floating through. And we already did this to Tupac. Was this not enough to put Tupac as a hologram?
That was really upsetting to me, actually. Yeah. I took it pretty hard when they did it. I just think it's wild to do that to someone who's dead. I mean, I would...
Let them die. When I'm dead, just
he's already, you know, weirdly immortalized through all these recordings, and now you're going to do it with his image as well. But I did want to say that there's this kind of tacit admittance that all the protest ever was this visual spectacle that you can just ignore if you want to ignore. Well, now it's not even a tangible entity. And you're saying that this is either just as good or maybe almost as good. There's a kind of admittance of the impotence that you always had in doing this.
Yeah, it's pretty dark situation. Also, one thing.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is happening in America, too. Someone made a statue. There was, like, a public statue. I forget which city it's in, but some city in America. And they made, like, a bronze bust of Edward Snowden because, you know, that guy's our hero. The NSA gone good. You got to love the NSA guy who's like, oh, maybe I'm kind of being a dick. And it's like, oh, look at you. You're not in the NSA anymore. Congratulations. I guess I'm being a little hard on Ed Snowden right now, but I feel like that's reasonable.
It's because you're showing the rider attitude that, like, once you've crossed the line, you're always going to be in the trash heap. And
sure. I mean, Edward
Snowden doesn't believe in people changing or redemption.
I don't know about redemption is quite a word to use there. It's a very Christian word. Anyways. But my whole point is that, so they took down the bust, like the cops took down the bust of Snowden because it was illegal or something. And what these people did was they projected a hologram of Snowden on the statue. So we're fucking, America's in the hologram game too. So, so Spain, you're not the only one. Fucking up your hologram game if you want to keep up with us. We're putting Snowden's fucking holographic face all over the place because we fucking love Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just like drones. The technology is here to stay, so now we have to start using it for the resistance.
Yeah, in case you're wondering, we still think Will Potter's an asshole.
So there's a certain kind of mindset, and I want to challenge you here, Rydra. There's a certain kind of mindset that says the fact that the state is trying to stop something, is trying to crack down on it, prevent it from happening, shows that it's potent and it is something that we should be doing. They're afraid of it. So one who wants to defend the mass movement paradigm might say, look, the fact that Spain is trying to stop this from happening shows that they're afraid of it.
Well, I think Spain also had, like, an actual revolution pretty recently, so they might be a different case where, like, revolution might seem a little more possible in a place like Spain where that happened in the last century, as opposed to some place like, you know, America, where the last time a revolution happened, it was, like,
what? To create America.
It was to create the place we live in. It was 100 years ago, you know?
100 years ago?
Hundreds of years ago. I know when the revolution happened.
I thought you said
1770s. Okay,
we'll
stupid.
Just cut this. I thought you said 100 years ago.
No, yeah, 100 years ago.
I thought that's what you said.
No, hundreds of years ago.
You know, there was also the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, like, was that really a revolution? Though,
half the half the country tried to secede.
So, as much as you want to say this, what the Civil War really was you know. It
was a fight over the type of servitude that would run the country.
I mean,
it was wage slavery versus chattel slavery. What's the most effective way?
I mean, and it's not like it really ended chattel slavery anyways. Like, they just made all those vagrancy laws in the South and other things that basically kept slavery functioning for a pretty decent amount of time after that. And we elected Andrew Johnson, who was basically the fucking Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. So that happened.
Okay, but returning to the protest and the fact that the state is trying to crack down on it.
Well, I'm just saying, I think in Spain that's more of a different situation than it is here.
Mm-hmm. I don't think
sometimes the state just gets pissed. They're like alcoholic, you know, abusive dads. Sometimes they don't really, you know, a lot of times they have the reason for being a dick, and sometimes they just come home drunk and want to fuck you up, you know?
I think sometimes the state does things just to show its power, but I also think as long as we are trying to define our resistance in terms of those lines that are set out for us, that we're always going to be recuperated. Someone said to me recently, to be noticed is to be recuperated. And I think that might be an extreme statement, but I think there's definitely a lot of truth to it that, as you, Rydra, like to say, that we need to start thinking outside of the norms and the history of resistance, because as much as the history of resistance can be inspiring and there are things to draw from it, it's also a history of largely failures.
Yeah. It's a long and storied way, thousands of years of disappointment.
Mm-hmm. I also find it frustrating that the people who are fond to say, like, look, the fact that we're being noticed and the fact that the state is responding to us means that we're effective. Don't tend to look further back. And we see, what was the way to break the back of American Indian resistance in this country? It was to cut off food supplies, to cut off the possibility of subsistence outside of the state and the economy.
You mean like mass murdering the bison?
Mass murdering the bison, damming the rivers. Yeah. There was explicit discussion among the lawmakers who were first making these dams saying we need to break the back of the American Indian populations that are feeding off of this. So if you really want to talk about responding to the state and seeing the way that they are trying to encroach and aggress on you, why don't we go back to the time when a huge part of the population of this country wasn't actually part of the state and see what was done to them?
Well, and,
this is why I think
what
I find
what they did not to become slaves, like, because they didn't become slaves. Like, the thing about the American Indians is that they did not become chattel slaves. They died. There was a lot of suicide. There was a lot of just, you know, war symmetrically and asymmetrically. A lot of people ended up, obviously, you know, now on reservation stuff, but, like, it did not work the same way as it did in a lot of other places. And what does that mean? What does that look like to not be willing to be held captive, to have many different people actually say, no, there's no circumstance under which I will join you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole thing I was trying to get at in the beginning with the Egyptians and the slaves at SETI Group, was that, well, you know, let's be honest with ourselves. There's some people and some people who have been more willing and more ready to accept that than other people. And I'm not trying to make, like, any type of judgment. I'm just saying, let's look at that and see what was the difference between like what made people absolutely refuse? Like what was there? And well, we have to go to break now, so we can talk about that later. So it's also that's also an open question to people. So this is Ryder. I'm sitting here with Bellamy. We have Rev Doc over in the corner. This is Free Radical.
Also, it's
Radio.
Rev Doc, not Rev Dog. This isn't Revolutionary Dog. It's the Reverend Doctor.
People think it's the Rev Dog. Yeah. I kind of like the Rev Dog, but I guess that's not their name, so we're not going to call them that. Anyways, you can find us on freeradicalradio.net. Free, you can email us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net. We have some type of Tumblr somewhere in the world. We also have a Facebook, and we're still not tweeting on the Twitter since. We're boycotting Twitter. Okay, this is Free Radical Radio. Thanks for listening.
Physical.
Welcome back to Free Radical Radio. This is your host, Rydra, of Red Pants On today. I got them very cheap.
Call it more salmon.
Salmon, yeah. They're very comfy, actually. I found some stretchy pants the other day, too, I've been wearing lately. It's been nice, but then I washed them and got some white stains on them. I don't know how to deal with it. Laundry has been a difficult battle for me for the last, like, 7 years I've been doing laundry.
You've gone so antisocial that you're doing the permanent sweatpants approach to life.
These are not sweatpants. These are jeans.
They're stretchy pants. They're kind of sweatpants.
No, stretchy jeans are not sweatpants. All right. This is not stretchy. This is regular. Stop touching my leg. I'm trying to do a show. All right. So things are getting frisky in the studio, and we're going to do the Notes on Progress segment where you say progress and I call bullshit. So you say people are getting less racist. You say the world's getting better. I say, fuck you, it's going to hell in a handbag. And not any kind of handbag, a very racist, homophobic handbag. So I don't know what handbag is racist, homophobic, but I'm sure it's possible. It's like a dreadlocked like type of like flamboyant thing. I don't really know. Who knows? I don't need to create different kinds of problematic handbags. Probably plenty of them out there. So, as much as anyone can care about a handbag, which I'm sure plenty of people do. So the Christian Science Monitor wanted to know if millennials were racist. And I want to know what the hell a millennial is.
Yeah. So two things. If you don't know what the Christian Science Monitor is, it's not really what it sounds like. It's actually a kind of leftist publication. I guess you would probably call it the sort of progressive liberal, you know, left of liberal.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. We actually looked up, because the whole generation thing was confusing to me, and now I know why. It's because there's not really a consensus on what...
Well, yeah, you were making fun of me for not knowing what a millennial was, and I told you I don't think anyone knows what a millennial is.
Yeah.
That's not true, actually.
No, it's not.
RevDoc is wrong.
Yeah. RevDoc thinks he's right.
Some people think they know the truth. Some people think they know the truth, and there is no truth.
The millennial has been cited as sometimes people born after the turn of the millennium, and at other times people that were born all the way up to the late 80s.
Right.
And then it's also defined as the generation that comes after Generation X, but it turns out Generation X is anyone, depending on who you ask, people who are children of the baby boomers, but then it's also people born all the way up into the early 80s, so it's not really, it's strange.
And thus ends the fascinating
generation
history of
consensus.
Cataloging.
All right, you know, I'm just saying, if you're talking about a survey of people, it's nice to know who the people are, but apparently we don't know, is my point.
You want to know who they are? I want to know where the people
are. I would just say they're younger
like
people.
Ariel and the Little Mermaid. Where the people are asking questions, getting answers. It's Little Mermaid. Just keep going.
This is your segment. Go.
Oh, okay, I'll go. So anyways, according to the... Did we already do this Economist thing? We did
this.
Oh, okay. So first we're going to tell you...
No. Okay, you're right. This is me. So general opinion is that millennials are more progressive, that they have more what we would call socially liberal attitudes. And they're... was a survey by The Economist saying that in general, younger people, millennials, are more likely to support same-sex marriage, more likely to be pro-choice, more likely to support the legalization of marijuana, and more likely to oppose animal testing for medical purposes. So
random thing you have the there.
Well, it's kind of the whole like catalog of left liberal opinions that you can have.
Well, but I guess this is just one of the many things. There's a very strong liberal strain that says like humans first and like some in the name of science, a chimpanzee must be tortured. Like that is a strong strain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Kind of humanist exclusionist.
Yeah. It's like this, it's kind of what I want to point out with this segment always, which is that, okay, look, you want to say these things about human beings. And it's also why I want to do the horrors of nature thing where we talk about how different animals like seem to cross morality and they like do terrible things. They torture things. They eat things. They kill entire populations. Sometimes, you know, they do, you know, animals do terrible things. So do plants. Friend was just telling me about a certain type of like plant that exists in the Northeast. It's like the kazu something moss. Anyways, but like
kuzu?
Kuzu, yeah, kuzu. Yeah. And how it just takes over. And that's not very friendly. It's just taking over all the space.
Imperialist plant.
Yeah, totally. That's rude. And, you know, people want to say that plant is fucked up and problematic, and they would be right saying that. So kind of the point of that whole idea would basically be to get people to admit that they are a human exceptionalist, where they think there's something that is inherently special about a human being that doesn't exist in the animal world and requires us to follow a certain set of morality. Which I would not call ethics.
What we're doing now, talking.
And, some people want to say talking is, like, RevDoc is the height of communication. I would say it's the lowest point communication has ever hit in the history of the world. So, anyways, in the history of the world.
The bacterial quorum was a much higher level of communication.
I agree. Excited that they could reach quorum. So let's just jump straight into this. So I'm kind of the opinion, obviously I'm biased going in, that things are getting worse. So anyways, the Christian, whatever you want to call them, the Christian Science Monitor took a look at 5 measures of racial prejudice from the General Social Survey conducted by NORC, I think that's National Organizing Resource Council, from their 2010, 2012, and 2014 waves of surveys. And among many other questions, the survey asked respondents to rate whites and blacks on a scale from being hardworking to lazy. So a lot of it was, like, very explicit. There's, like, a whole long list of questions they asked. They also showed images of different black people, white people, Latino people, et cetera, and, like, asked how people felt about this. And if you look, we'll put the link up to the website when the show comes out. So if you're listening, you can click on this link to look at the study in more depth. But, like, it's pretty bold. So here are some of the gems from the study. Over 3 in 10 white millennials believe blacks to be lazier or less hardworking than whites. And a similar number say the lack of motivation is a reason why they're less financially well-off as a group. Just under a quarter, that's 1 in 4 white people, believe blacks are less intelligent. That is a significant number of people. That is millions, tens of millions of people who believe this. That is not a small number. And let's go to the next one. When it comes to explicit prejudice against blacks, non-Hispanic white millennials are not much different than whites belonging to Generation X, which is...
they actually defined it. Okay.
Yeah, they just defined it here. Born between 1965 to 1980, or baby boomers born between 1946 to 1964. So what they ended up finding was there's no statistical evidence that there has been any progress made in terms of people's prejudice and racism. And in another study, University of Michigan political scientist Vincent Hutchings found that, quote, younger cohorts of whites are no more racially liberal in 2008 than they were in 1988. And that's a 2009 article, which just comes to the same conclusion.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, I've always been fond of saying oppression hasn't decreased. It's just diversified and in a lot of ways become more subtle. And so, for instance, where I grew up in northern Ohio, I encountered many people among the baby boomer generation that were quite comfortable using racial epithets openly and seemed genuinely surprised at times that some people would react negatively to it. And so you have that much more overt kind of in-your-face confrontational racism, whereas among younger people who often were raised by these very same people using the racial epithets, they wouldn't be comfortable using those in public, but they might hold very similar attitudes. They're just going to voice them in more subtle ways.
Well, we talked about this on the show when it happened, too, but I think it's worth mentioning again, which is that the Los Angeles Clippers basketball team owner Donald Sterling came under fire last year for basically telling his girlfriend not to associate with blacks in public or whatever.
Yeah, that it was embarrassing to him.
Sure.
Yeah.
But the thing is, most of the owners of the basketball teams are old white billionaires, and I'm going to guarantee you that opinion is probably held among almost all of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe you have a liberal or two in there, like who is apparently just as racist according to like everything that's going on. So even that wouldn't change anything. But I think the whole thing that kind of showed was that if anything, we're trying to cleanse the spectacle and cleanse the public view of this particular society. I'll just talk about American society in general and try to show that it's not homophobic, that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Like Kobe Bryant, I'm going to use another basketball story because we're in the basketball thing. He got in trouble because he called a fan like a fag or something that was yelling at him. And, you know, he had to apologize. And so he apologized to the gay community as a whole. Like,
such a meaningless gesture.
Do we choose to accept that apology? Who cares? Like about Kobe Bryant, this is a very not awesome human being for a variety of different reasons who has come under public fire for, you know, pretty obviously raping this woman. It did not seem like there was much controversy there when you get to the bottom of it. But more what I'm trying to say is that all we do is cleanse the spectacle of the dirty things that are so prevalent in society, but it does not make them less prevalent just because we cleanse the spectacle of them.
Yeah, it's funny. This reminds me of when I talked to Zoltan Isvan, and he was citing as an example of progress, he was talking about it in the context of saying that the oligarchs, well, he said oligarchs and then he backed down from using the word oligarchs, but he was saying the oligarchs of today are different from the ones of the Gilded Age. And he was saying part of the reason being that with mass communication and so much public scrutiny that now when people, I think he said something like when people say things that are not egalitarian, but basically he's talking about things like this. If someone's obviously racist, if someone's obviously patriarchal, they tend to get called out in this kind of massified way through mass communication where there's this public condemnation of people like Donald Sterling. And he was very obviously seeing that as a kind of, you know, it's almost like God's eye of judgment is on us all. And if anyone does something that's overtly oppressive, they get shamed. And I mean, you see that now with things like Sterling, where people react. But apparently a good number of those people who are reacting in that way are still holding these very racist views, but just doing so much more covertly.
Yeah, and I think it's annoying that people want to call me or call anyone who doesn't believe in the narrative progress pessimistic, because I don't think I think being a realist about something is not pessimistic. Like, it's different.
The first line of defense of the pessimist is to call themselves a realist.
Well, I'm just saying, if you honestly look at a situation, it's, you know, it's like looking at anarchy or anything else and saying, like, maybe this isn't going so well. Maybe we should try something else. Like, you know, I'm pessimistic that if I eat 25 pounds of ice cream a day, that tomorrow, you know, I'll wake up in 2 weeks and be super ripped. I don't think that's very reasonable. I think that's also, like, what the narrative of progress is that people keep doing different things to change legislation, to do this or do that. Or, you know, it's not okay to call people certain racial epithets in public anymore like it used to be. And has that actually changed the material condition for people or the amount of prejudice that people hold? It seems like it hasn't to me. And I don't think that's pessimistic. I think it's more just saying, look, this thing you've been doing for a long time doesn't work. And there's got to be another way. Is there a way to not have such a fucking shitty-ass racist society or not have society anymore? Yeah, I think there is. I'm optimistic that we could live a different way and that it doesn't need to be like this, but I'm pessimistic that we can just keep fucking putting the square peg in the round hole of society and a decent life and pretend like they're going to fit together.
Yeah, which is, I think, one of the glaring weaknesses of a big part of the leftist project is about having the right language. And the idea being that if we have the right language, if we clean up the domination inherent in our language, which I would argue is impossible, that if we can just clean up our language, the thoughts will follow. And I think we see here a possible counterexample where our language, I think, is much, much cleaner and nicer looking and gentler in a lot of ways, but apparently the racist thoughts remain. I did want to... This talking about progress recently, now that you've added this section of notes on progress, I wanted to call your attention to some months ago, you said something like, yes, I do believe in progress. I think things are getting shittier all the time.
I believe in regress.
Right. So do you believe in regress?
I do. I do actually think that.
So you think
things are
from
getting worse.
Sumeria.
Yeah.
What Sumeria actually was the high point.
At least they got to live outside most of the day. I don't live outside most of the day. I spend like 90% of my time, you know, inside.
So Sumeria was the high point of civilization, and then we have a gradual fall through
yes.
Babylon, through Greece, through Rome, through... Yeah?
Yeah. Things are just getting worse, and now we've reached the height. And
so this is the worst point.
I can show you why it's the worst point with the next segment.
All right. Go ahead.
All right. So As the World Burns, where we show you what progress looks like. And progress looks like a thing called a technology lake. So what is a technology lake, you ask yourself?
When Hammurabi was laying down laws that, you know, people's hands were getting cut off for stealing things.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that doesn't happen anymore in our world.
I'm just saying that there are places where it doesn't happen. See, I would argue that that they're difficult to compare. They're incommensurable. In some ways, things are much worse. In some ways, things are better. Overall... We're in about the same boat as we were in Sumeria.
Oh, no way. It's way more difficult.
The eco side is deeper. I think the difference is that the destruction of the non-human world is at an all-time high.
I'm going to bring up some wilder sin right now, which is that it's way worse now because we have no spaces. We have no land to run to. At least in Sumeria,
true.
They could get...
No, that's
they
a good could, point. People yeah, you had, could escape.
People had a chance to run away and live free. People could run away and attack. People could... The numbers were more reasonable. You know, there... This is the most interesting part about slavery is even its beginning, they were more slaves than masters. Like, that's the thing about slavery. Like, they probably could have revolted. They didn't for reasons that were not physical and material, reasons I don't know the answer to, but they exist, whatever they are. And that to me, is a way better situation to be in, where I can run, and the world is not completely covered with terrible fucking bullshit societies that are all basically the same, spanning the entire globe. This is a fucking nightmare right now. I find it incredible that you can actually say that you think it's
different.
not demonstrably worse now.
I think the fact that that space has been taken over in a way that's unparalleled is a very good point.
Like Mars, like Barack Obama?
No, I'm talking about space on the Earth.
Oh, yeah.
Geography.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that's a good point.
Okay, thank you. All right, so you're wondering, you might be wondering right now, as I wondered when I saw this headline, is a technology lake like a lake that is not real? It's a holographic lake? Is it?
It's gray goo.
Yeah,
it's nanomachines.
You know, do you jump in the lake and it makes you a cyborg? Does it like heal you? No. What it actually is just a kind of man-made lake of black oozy goo from rare earth mineral mining. So let's talk about that for a second. So recently, our great friends over at the BBC, we talk to them all the time. We're very tight with them. Sometimes they come over to our house for dinner. The whole BBC, actually. What is it? The British Babylonian Collective? What do they stand for? I don't know.
British Broadcasting Company.
That makes more sense. Really, they're Babylonian, though. They support Babylon. All right. They might not, actually. I'm getting
just
the wave on
go.
Signal.
Go.
Okay. So I'm just going to start I'm going to read a quote from the article that I thought is pretty awesome, and I'm going to apologize for mispronouncing things. This is from someone visiting this lake in Inner Mongolia. From where I'm standing, the city-sized Bagong steel and rare earth complex dominates the horizon. Its endless cooling towers and chimneys reaching up into gray, washed-out sky. Between it and me, stretching into the distance, lies an artificial lake filled with a black, barely liquid, toxic sludge. So the person continues on. I'm going to read the next thing they say because I think their experience describing it is probably besides looking at the pictures, the best way to really feel what's going on. They said, I'd seen some photos before I left for Inner Mongolia, but nothing prepared me for the sight. The alien environment at Bateau Lake. Dozens of pipes line the shore, churning out a torrent of thick, black chemical waste from the refineries that surround the lake. The smell of sulfur and the roar of pipes invades my senses. It feels like hell on earth. Welcome to Batau, the largest industrial city in Inner Mongolia. So, this is going to be linked online too, but you can see on Google Maps actually how gnarly this lake is. And it's actually black. And there's pipes with just like black sludge, many of them just filtering in, and this is the world of Apple and iPhones and progress that people don't want you to see.
Right. So just to contextualize it for people that might not be aware, so rare earth metals are essentially what they sound like, minerals that are difficult to find. They don't occur commonly, but many of them are integral to high-tech devices, and they fulfill various oddball purposes in everything from automobiles to iPhones, tablets, to even speakers, and they are essential for all this high-tech life, and this is the consequence. And China, unsurprisingly, processes the vast majority of these. 95% of them come from there, and so in order for the high-tech society to keep going, this lake needs to keep getting larger.
Yeah. Well, also, the other thing is, like, some of the rare minerals are actually rare, like the ones we were just talking about. But some of them aren't even rare. Like, for instance, neodymium. So China produces 90% of the market for this, even though they only have 30% of the world's deposits. And that's basically the probable reason for this is, which this is saying a lot, knowing what fracking entails here in America and other places, is they're the only people willing to fucking produce something so fucking dirty to make. Mm-hmm. And that's saying a lot of, like, how bad something is. If there's, like, you know, if there's another country that's like, maybe that's actually too bad for the environment to do.
Yeah. And I think one of the consequences of globalization, right, is you have this race to the bottom, as it's been called, where the governments that are most willing to have the minimal environmental protection laws, the minimal workers' rights laws, the absolute lowest wages, their plutocrats are able to profit off of this, right? So you have, for every supposedly enlightened democracy you have to have a corresponding hellhole in order to have the kinds of production that you want on the global scale.
Yeah, I mean, it's dirty business.
Mm-hmm.
Business ain't clean, much like our language in America, which is very clean. It belies a dark underbelly of racism, prejudice, homophobia, all the goodies that have existed for a long time to keep us in the situation we're in. Different tools used to keep the situation much the same. I wish I was in Sumeria. At least I'd have a chance.
You'd have a chance.
At least I'd have a chance, a fighting shot.
You'd have been dead before you were 10.
could have raised a rebel army and gone after the Lugal. Right?
Yeah, fuck you, Lugal Lizzie. You want some of this?
All right. So, goodness. So, yeah, again, with the diversification and the subtlety of the gross realities, as civilization develops and advances, what you do is you localize and you make covert the horrors. How many people are ever going to see this lake? And, you know, even with the BBC putting it out there in the, you know, click news culture, it's like, oh, that's nasty. I guess this was necessary for me to have this device that I'm observing it on. Well,
better get some Skittles so I don't have to feel bad about this anymore.
Well, Miley Cyrus posted another selfie. It's pretty hot. Maybe I'll just go over here.
Also, T-Swift's new jam is like one sick beat. So
this sick beat.
Yeah.
Okay. And jumping off of that, we have a Luddites Anonymous section. Post-industrialism is a term that gets thrown around often in misleading ways, I would say. What it technically refers to is a culture whose economy has become more based on service. So the service sector, or what's sometimes called the tertiary sector, the primary sector being agriculture, the secondary sector being manufacturing, and the tertiary sector being service. When a society is mostly based on, or an economy is mostly based on service, you're said to be a post-industrial country. But I think it also gives this kind of veneer of the ugliness of massive industrial apparatus being something in the past. We have this idea that there's less and less hardware, less and less material architecture to the high-tech world. You know, you have cloud, like data storage is, you know, where is it? You know, we don't have to have all these giant hard disks. It's just sort of floating around in space. At least that's the illusion. And there is another good BBC piece that we'll post too that was talking about the kind of unseen, unspoken about massive industrial apparatus that's necessary for distributing goods everywhere. And they talked about a corporation called Maersk. I don't know.
Yeah, they're the ones who have their names on all the like the shipping containers.
Right. So it's a Danish company. Very big company, 25,000 employees, offices in 125 countries. They have 600 ships going around.
Multinational, motherfucker.
And as Ryder was saying, the containers, they have over 2 million containers moving around every year.
Jesus.
Yeah. And there's a BBC piece that I would say engages in the kind of margarine phenomenon of, Barthez calls it, of calling into question the whole apparatus just enough to raise feelings of doubt, concern, pity, fear, only to then rationalize it and therefore put the whole process of questioning it into doubt. And so this reporter actually goes on one of Maersk's ships and sees the life of the employees there, sees the toxic consequences of this whole procedure, and the reporter talks about the massive apparatus of cranes, refineries, ports, ships, containers, talking about how, you know, we don't see this stuff. There's this idea that maybe it's not really there. We're blind to the consequences. And interestingly, he talks not only about the toxicity that goes along with all this, but also the alienation of the people involved in it and the transformation of consciousness that we all end up experiencing as a consequence of this. The reporter writes, "In a very real sense, the crane and truck drivers are little more than elements in a vast robotic system, receiving instructions in their cabs from their computerized managers, following orders on endless cycles until their shift ends." And so, amazingly, in mainstream, you see a kind of calling into question of cybernetics, seeing that cybernetics means the flattening of perceptual experience. People more and more have these standardized and homogenized inputs. The human being just becomes the nexus between two machines. And, I mean, is a pretty high-end criticism of just the work culture in general and industrialism. And later they end up using the word alienation to talk about how the ships are being managed by email and satellite. The crew doesn't even know the contents of the containers that they're shipping. The crew doesn't really engage in navigation. Maybe the sense of adventure, of mystery, of the ocean as this vast, unknowable thing is being lost. But then they bounce around and say, not that there isn't a certain amount of pride in their work, as regimented and alienating as it might seem. It's not unusual to see the cranes decorated with awards and badges announcing record-breaking container-shifting performances. At the same time, it's also impossible not to be struck by the... we'll skip that part. But just incredible reduction and diminution of the human being there, that your success is being a faster part of the industrial process that they were just calling into question. I mean, how can you pretend that you don't see this as part of the psycho-engineering of the workplace, that you... you know, hold out the little carrots to make people undergoing this.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's quite a system. It seems like there's also a lot of purely robotic stuff going on. It seemed like, you know, with the, you know, one of the places they were talking about this article, it just seemed like there was almost devoid of human life at all. It was just some type of weird techno dystopian robot moving, like, thing.
Yeah, the part that I skipped, they end up talking about how in some places on these ports, they actually have eliminated the human element entirely, and the cranes are just entirely robotic.
That's a great sentence. They have managed to eliminate the human element entirely.
I think the zenith of this culture will be when the production just occurs for its own sake, right? The human element is... the idea that somehow this whole thing is aimed at human happiness is finally erased, and the production just starts going on for its own sake.
Well, I guess the good news for the pessimistic voluntary human extinction movement, or the average one of those, is that eventually there's a great possibility that artificial intelligence and robotic life will just end human life, because who wants that vicious human element? We're unpredictable, we're savage, we're angry, we're murderous, we're lusty, and we don't smell that great to some people. I think I smell delicious, but that's just me.
So, one more interesting bit before we go to the break. The reporter writes, "The surfaces of our planet's oceans, for centuries a space of mystery and myth, of expanse and desolation, have been rationalized and shrunk. Once an enigmatic, awe-inspiring place, the sea has become a zone of efficiency, little more than another channel for the automated supply chain network." So, this was great and really amazing to me. We have the recognition that if you realize... if you acknowledge the expanse of self, that you're not just your little body, but that you extend to all the social interactions you have, to the non-human organisms that you encounter in your life, that you know, to gaze at a mountain is very different to gaze at a parking lot, then you realize that the ideology of control is the reduction of the self. When we seek efficiency and control over the world, we flatten ourselves. When we put guiding lines on the road, we're fencing our emotions, we're fencing ourselves off from possibilities. But then they fucking turn it around again, and after going through all this shit of how bad this is for the people, of how bad this is, of how this person is experiencing all these really negative emotions just being a reporter on this whole process, here's how it fucking ends. "I'd initially thought it might be fun, healthy even, to truly escape the internet and life back home for a few days. That was before I realized what the Seletar really was, saw how it was just another node in the network, another rationalized point in the global infrastructure, a bridge between the physical and the digital. Once I saw that, I knew it was time to abandon my romantic notions of being away at sea, that it was pointless to resist the lure of the network, and found myself squatting in the stairwell between decks C and D trying to get reconnected." Really? Let's go to break, and then we can talk about that.
Thank you.
We got cut off there by the 30-minute segment phenomenon, where I was really down to the wire there, trying to get all the information.
We're arbitrarily 30 minutes is the cutoff point for some reason.
These are the lines that we have drawn for no good reason, or for some good reason.
My computer doesn't crash.
Yeah, something about RAM. Not as in the nice hoofed animal.
Does RAM stand for really awesome memory?
Random access memory. So, to unpack that a bit, I think the piece, which we'll post on there, the BBC piece, it could be read as this kind of ironic gesture where the author's trying to get at the horror by showing how they themselves even capitulate to it. But I do think we're really at that point in a lot of ways, and this is the kind of lousy, whining, self-castrating pessimism that is, I think, distinct from the kind of pessimism that Ryder was talking about enters in there, where it's just, you know, we see the toxic lake, we see the reduction of the human being, we see how the idea of some kind of totalizing knowledge or totalizing control or efficiency really reduces the human being, reduces the inner world, as John Zerzan likes to say, the mutilation of consciousness is, as I've been saying more recently, is happening. And somehow it's just, well, here we are. Let's just make ourselves as comfortable as possible. And the author ends up talking about the kind of irony or the horrifying phenomenon that when these people, when the workers get off these boats, they're just trying to find a Wi-Fi signal so that they can talk to their families. And, you know, even as obviously the mere fact that you need the Wi-Fi signal in the first place is part of the reason that this whole apparatus exists, that's separating them from their families in the first place. And it's sad to say, I think a lot of people are at that point. There are some people who aren't at that point. And we wanted to talk about something Nicola Guy wrote a while back, talking about the obstacles to action. And so I'm going to read some bits of what...
You should mention who they are first.
So Nicola Guy of Nicola and Alfredo, who I think it was in 2012?
Yeah.
They attempted to assassinate a nuclear executive, waited outside of his house on a motorbike. As he emerged from the house, took a shot at him, ended up hitting the guy in the knee. He was injured but not killed. They took off on a motorbike. Later, allegedly they engaged in all of this, and then later on were arrested for it, and they're still incarcerated presently. So Nicola writes, and I'm going to read a few sections from this. It's a longer piece. It's at 325 No State. We will post the link.
It's a great place to go if you want to be surveilled on the internet.
Yeah. I think we wanted to bring this up because it was called to our attention by various folks that a lot of people outside of Europe don't actually know about these people, and they don't get talked about very much. And so we wanted to talk about some folks outside the United States. At Free Radical Radio, we tend to talk a lot about people who are doing stuff in this country.
We're like North American focused, I would say, with our heavy wild reaction influence. And we got
That's
into
true.
The whole, how do you say
Mi'kmaq?
It?
Mi'kmaq?
Yeah.
If someone let us know that we were saying Mi'kmaq incorrectly for a very long time. Whoops. Sorry about that. So, Nicola writes...
And our language will now be clean. Clean language on the show only. Go ahead.
So, Nicola writes, and again, I'm just reading excerpts. Without doubt, one of the greatest and most serious obstacles to action is the fear of really putting our lives at stake. This is a crucial point of the revolutionary struggle, which is often not sufficiently addressed because it forces us to come to terms with ourselves and our weaknesses. We praise so-called easily reproducible small actions, which I gotta say, I've done that myself, which certainly don't frighten the people, quote-unquote. And even if we are aware of the urgency and necessity of destructive attack on the authoritarian technological system, we are reluctant to get involved to the end, to consider ourselves at war and act consequently. Certainly, it is much easier to find oneself along with hundreds, thousands of people defending a territory threatened by some eco-monstrosity than to find oneself on one's own, waiting for the planner of the monstrosity outside his house. So there you go with the rather explicit reference to what they did.
Well, I think I want to jump in real quick and say that it has a lot to do with what we were talking about earlier, where certain people won't be slaves either. And I'm like, there were certain peoples, like many American Indians, who would not be slaves. And there are certain people, such as, you know, Nicola refused normal life. And so did, you know, so do certain people in, like, Wild Reaction. And so do, like, Novatori, people that live like that. Like, they lived at war with society. And there's other people who ingratiate themselves into society because, I mean, fuck, it's a pretty big deal to live this kind of life.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you were saying, something distinct about our moment in the present is that it's really difficult to do that. I mean, Novatori was able to do what he did partially because, you know, to some extent, you can just skip town. And
we had a much better chance to get away with that kind of stuff than we would
right.
now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously the punishment, well,
the lack of surveillance.
Him, so I'm not going to say the punishment is worse now, but the idea of lifelong jail time is pretty bad.
But also, I mean, the lack of the panopticon, which, as we've said, it is partially just an emotional phenomenon, the feeling of constant surveillance. But things were very different. I mean, in Sumeria, you know, if you killed the Lugal's brother, you could run away, and at a certain point, they would never, I mean, they're not going to track you down.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Nicola continues, we can share our responsibilities with others and hope we won't be alone when things take a bad turn. We don't realize how much of our individual freedom we are losing. On the contrary, we feel reassured by the limits imposed by meetings, where we can hide our indecision behind the risk that our impatience could undermine the common project. Here's a really good take on what Ron Sikalski has called mutual acquiescence, the way that we just sort of naturalize, validate each other's behaviors, validate each other's unwillingness to make the wager, as he's putting it. It feels a lot easier to do that when surrounding ourselves with other so-called radicals that also don't want to do these kinds of things. Nicola writes later, I'm skipping, we have to strike the company responsible for the construction of the toxicity, those who plan it, those who finance it. We have to make it clear that anyone can take their lives in their hands and destroy what destroys them.
Ah. Yeah.
Familiar phrase there.
Yeah, we have this, this is apparently an unpopular opinion for many people, as we ran into when we maybe endorsed something like this months ago.
We have to clash with the police, not only when they try to disperse the demo in question. We have to provoke and attack them, let people see that it is possible, that they can and must strike first those who oppress them. Some might say my way of seeing things and understanding action can harbor the germs of authoritarianism and vanguardism. On the contrary, I believe that my way contains the antidote to the two evils that plague revolutionary action. One doesn't disguise one's desires. One says clearly who one is and what one wants, and above all, in an equal relationship with others, one demonstrates that anyone can concretely oppose the status quo by arming their passions. So very much endorsing the kind of propaganda of the deed that we've also talked about on the show, that the mere act of doing something shows that it's accessible, that you don't have to be some sort of Herculean individual. You don't have to be some kind of academic who can analyze absolutely everything to death. You can just be a regular person. I mean, I think what Nicola's trying to get at here is that he's not some sort of special monumental individual, but he's just someone who's decided to play the wager.
Yeah, I want to read the next segment. I want to talk about that one.
Later on, Nicola writes, in my opinion, politics lies exactly in the way one limits oneself in order to keep pace with all the others, in the way one puts some discourses aside in order not to, quote, frighten, unquote, people who are not ready to understand them. It must be clear that anarchists look for accomplices with whom to rise up, and not public opinion in favor of vague speeches on freedom and self-management.
I mean, that is basically what we began the show talking about today, which, and what we talked about later, is the idea of, like, cleaning up speech, like, trying to, there's a big difference between trying to find an accomplice to, like, as Nicola would say, rise up with, and to try to turn public opinion in your favor. And, you know, it's going to happen. Like, if you, I mean, those, what were those comics, like, anarchists, modern-day anarchists in the Spanish Revolution? Like, those comics were, like, whatever, I didn't think they were super great, but they did point to the fact that...
Oh, it was supposed to be if anarchists today were at the Spanish Revolution.
And it was just, like, a lot of complaint. Like, someone called someone a cow, and they were like, that's fucked up, you know, or, like, whatever, all the various different things. Like, it was just basically, like, throwing anti-oppression politics into, like, a war situation. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, a lot of people just want to clean up the community and act as somehow if we clean up like the radical and the anarchist and the leftist community and make it look nice and make sure no one's triggered and no one's hurt and make sure everyone's language is nice and perfect, that then what's going to happen? What does that even mean? What does that mean to be doing things like that and not and just being a part of society?
So I think what they would say is that it's not an end in itself, but it's wanting our means to resemble our ends. So we can, if we learn how to treat one another respectfully and as full human beings, we will prefigure the world, and that can happen alongside other things that are happening. And then that way, when we arrive at the world that we would want to see, we're not going to end up reproducing it through having oppressive thought patterns and ways of relating to each other. And what would you say to that?
I don't know. I mean, is that like be the change you wish to see in the world type stuff?
I think it's building the shell of the new and building the world we want in the shell of the old.
I mean, I think the best only thing you can do is like Count of Monte Cristo. Like, we're basically in a prison. So the best kind of shell you could build build your new world is some type of a revenge situation. You can't build something better than that. I don't feel like I think this is where I always get into with people is where I say, I mean, many of our desires and things like that are controlled by society. But there are desires. I don't believe all my desires are my own desires. I don't even half believe that half my desires are my own desires. So I'm trying to prefigure a world and what it's going to look like when I don't even know what I desire right now. Like, I want to be free to let my desires flow freely then. And only then can I figure out how I want to live.
And what I would say is that the dominant culture is pretty well equipped to recuperate all those things. I think we've seen again and again how it can just include people more and more in its cloying embrace. And as long as you are willing to plug into the citizen consumer worker role, the state ultimately is happy to accommodate you. I think chattel slavery ended up giving way at the same time as it was recuperated in the form of wage slavery. So it became ultimately fine for power. The powerful were divided as to whether keeping chattel slavery was a good idea, but ultimately it proved fine certain parts of the black population were worse off after slavery temporarily, just being on the absolute bottom rung of wage slavery and then also having to deal with all the continuing racism on top of that. And I think I'm not saying that all anti-oppression practice is worthless. I wouldn't say that. I would say the way that it ends up getting deployed is often as an end in itself. In other words, if we can just make everyone on the same footing, we're actually advancing a lot, and these are huge successes. But so long as everyone's still a worker, consumer, citizen, and you still have an ever-growing toxic lake in Inner Mongolia, and you still have this giant industrial shipping apparatus that's absolutely reducing, measuring, quantifying the world and plugging everyone into a cybernetic model of efficiency, we're really not getting anywhere at all. I mean, Barack Obama said in his most recent State of the Union speech is talking about transgender people, and somehow this is a success, even though transgender people are still being killed just for who they are everywhere on a regular basis. And what? It would be some kind of great success to have them eventually be brought into a worker, consumer, citizen role like everyone else?
Well, it's just like, why are we even going to pay attention or believe or acknowledge anything that someone like the president would have an opinion on this? Why do we even dignify and act like there possibly could be some benefit there? It's really, really fucking absurd. And the only way to do that is to have a slightly fucking better society, which, in case you didn't realize, like, society is going to require a hierarchy of individuals, so all the best possible situation would be is to put different people on the bottom rung. The bottom rung will still exist. Life will still suck for the majority of people.
Or the rungs won't end up breaking down along demographic lines as they often do now.
Sure.
But the rungs will still exist. And I think, you know, again, to invoke Wilderson, you know, in a lot of ways, you have the erosion. I mean, you have the erosion of specific laws based on race. You have the erosion of employment exclusion, housing exclusion based on race, but you absolutely still have a racial hierarchy.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, you have a black president or a half-black president now. Has that done anything? I mean, if you had a transgender president, would that be doing so much for transgender people?
And just think of, like, how long. Like, if you want to think about how much better things are, just think about how many years more the society would have to exist before a trans president could be elected, an openly trans president. It's, like, literally centuries away from that in terms of, like, how much the average person, like, hates trans people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not to get into the, like, there's a whole other conversation to be had there, too, about, like, other, let's just not get into that right now.
I'm not actually sure what you're talking
about.
Okay,
that's fine. Keep going.
Okay, so Nicola continues. Before I conclude, I would like to dwell on another aspect that seems to be an obstacle to our action, the analysis of the effects and transformations of dominion. Far too often, it seems that this analysis is useless and doesn't give us the ability to affect reality. On the contrary, it feeds fear and sense of impotence in the face of the magnitude of the challenge and the monstrosity of the harmfulness to be opposed. The more we analyze the authoritarian and deleterious aspects of technology and denounce the authoritarian projects of power, the less we sharpen our weapons. So, you could actually say that about Free Radical Radio.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's a pretty good criticism of us, and one I think is totally true and worth mentioning, which is the fact that a lot of people just sit there and participate on the sidelines of opinion giving, and I have much more fondness for action than opinion giving, even though I'm very fond of opinion giving.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think one thing is there's analysis that is, as a friend of ours likes to say, futilitarian, and there's an analysis that I think is encouraging. And one thing we try to do on here, and you could say we succeed or fail to whatever extent, is I have always tried to encourage action, and I've tried to encourage action by showing that a lot of it is accessible. And Nicola was criticizing that, saying, we endorse things that are less confrontational, and then we call it success. Well, I actually do think that a lot of things are out there that aren't as confrontational as what they're doing that are still valuable. And I don't think we ought to be using as an evaluative metric the confrontation of something as the hard and fast actuality of its effectiveness. I think there are things that are less confrontational that are more effective. I think there are things that are less confrontational that are less effective.
Well, sure. I'd say, the only real thing I actually am not interested in their communique or their writing right there is that I don't see it as effective just doing the old typical street battle with the police. I think there's other ways people have chosen to deal with the police. Take that for what you will. That seem a lot more effective and a lot.
Well, but
better
he was saying not just when they attack us.
Right. Right. Sure. I mean, I'm obviously this person that supports the other ways to deal with the police too. But I'm just saying maybe if there was more different things going on as opposed to so much of the same thing, which is people coming into anarchy through leftism, through protest. The high point of which is a FTP march where they know you're coming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe they shouldn't know when we're coming. You know what I'm saying?
maybe we shouldn't talk about those marches online.
Yeah.
Where the police can very easily.
Sure.
I'm sure. We know that police have people being paid just to go around poking around on the internet looking for people planning stuff. So, you know, maybe don't post every single thing you're going to do on IndieBay.
Seems reasonable. I'm just surprised people still go to IndieBay.
Yeah.
I don't go to IndieBay.
That's good. Yeah, I guess you're...
All right, so we're going to jump into some random...
Really, your higher level in anarchy world.
That's true. So we're gonna jump into some other segments here. So I saw something that just pissed me off in general about school. And there's like these charter schools, and they're all over. But in New York especially, they're particularly ridiculous. You know, it's the kind of place you send your kid to learn five languages and become a violin virtuoso and then go to MIT when they're 14 and then rule the world or something like that. And a lot of these places are just basically another version of hell. And I will always say school is prison. You know, people want to get upset and say, oh, no, like you get to go home. What, to your probably shitty-ass parents or to be a latchkey kid like most people? This is not exactly the glory days for most people growing up in this society. So anyways, I'm going to read a quote from a New York Times report on what's going on at the school. So former staff members describe students in the third grade and above wetting themselves during practice tests, either because students did not allow them to go to the bathroom or because the students themselves felt so much pressure they did not want to lose time on the test. So one former teacher told the New York Times that she heard, this is the name of the school, a Success Academy vice principal say, quote, this is what the vice principal did. They, quote, praised the dedication of a child who had wet his pants rather than take a break. So they were actually saying, like, hey, good job peeing your pants. You really care about this test. Like, this is how much you care. I mean, and this is like, I mean, that's like a form of flagellation on some level. This is like, you know, they're just endorsing masochism and not like the fun type of masochism, you know?
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, again, the incredible reduction of the human being, the human possibility to this. You will ignore your body in favor of a completely abstract measure of who you are that's totally divorced from your...
test. It's not even a real test. Practice test. Yeah.
Totally divorced from any of your actual values. And I think I said some months ago on the show that I was out and about driving around and I really had to piss. And I'm just going around and around trying to find a bathroom that's going to let me in. And I had the realization... You know, only a truly domesticated animal is going to hold its urine to the point of pain and distress rather than just take a piss.
How often are we just in pain? Because, like, what, we don't want to get our clothes wet or something?
Yeah, and you can't talk about it. Like, if you're in a job interview and you're like, oh, hey, actually, I have to go to the bathroom. Like,
or you're worried.
Your chance of getting that job is lower.
Or you're worried you're going to be a sexual predator if you go out and just piss on the street because, God forbid, someone sees a fucking penis or vagina fucking urinating out on the street and it's the end of the world and now that person has to register as a sex offender because they didn't want to fucking sit there in pain for peeing and they've traumatized someone with their fucking disgusting ass body, which is the way we look at bodies in this society, is that they're fucking things to be hidden. And I mean, this happened to me once at school, but it was when I was 18, so I was like already done with school. That like I had my time of like being like, oh, authority, like I will let you authoritize me. And by this time I was done with that. And I was 18 in some bullshit math class that I already didn't care about. I was already failing out of school. Like, the only reason I was still passing was because my parents were, like, clearing absences because they, like, had some vague idea that it was important for me to graduate while I was trying to get out of there and, you know, ditching most of the time. So I ended up at school, which at this point I was probably going to school, like, 30% of the time. And some substitute teacher, not even my regular teacher, I'm just like, I raised my hand, I'm like, hey, I'm going to go to the bathroom. I don't even know why I let her know. Why do we even have to let people know why we're leaving the classroom? Can't we just be reasonable people that don't want to be there anymore? So anyways, I raised my hand, I'm like, all right, I'm going to the bathroom. And she looks at me and she's like, no, you have to wait. And I'm like, and I was just like, are you serious? Like, wait. And she started like basically telling me I had to wait for like this one, she was like teaching something. She was a substitute, it wasn't even real. She was like doing some math thing, trying to teach us something that I was never going to use and never have used since then. And I look at her, I'm like, all right, you have two options right now. I'm a big fan of presenting people with options. I'm like, option number one is I shit in the trash can right now, right here. Option number two is you ease up and just like let me go to the bathroom. I'm like, those are your two options. You have 5 seconds to decide. And she looks at me all kind of like frustrated, and she's just like, just go to the bathroom. And I was like, fuck you. Substitute asshole. Fucking teachers, man. Teachers are usually the worst. And I used to be a teacher. This is coming from a teacher. Basically prison guards, glorified prison guards. The last time I told a teacher this, they were not pleased with me.
Cerner counts the teachers among the police.
Yeah, of course. Teachers are total police. I'm gonna do another camp thing at my work. It's gonna be like spring camp. I had fall camp last time or whatever. And I'm gonna have to do these dumb things again where the teacher's gonna tell the kids that they can't destroy the world and that that's bad and that they should be having like pizza Sunday or church Sunday and that all these other different ideas that are really interesting and fun are wrong. Can't have dragons run around shooting guns at all the people we don't like.
Dragons?
I don't know. Just the things kids draw in school.
Oh, I see. I see. I wanted to take a minute to promote the Black and Green Forum. Lots of people are fond in anarchy world of having Facebook arguments that go nowhere and they just get like really fast and you see everyone's commenting like 1 minute after the other. Well, now you can do that in a slightly more sane form. It's a little bit slower, I think a little bit more thoughtful. It's broken down by subject and category. There's a grit section where you're talking about the more, you could say, academic or formal ways, talking about things like delayed return. Then there's a kind of open section. You can talk about anything. There's an anarchist media section where they talk about people like us. And I would encourage checking
someone
out
someone like you.
Black and Green Forum. I think it's blackandgreen.freeforum.net, I think. And yeah, we'll put a link
just
on there.
Google Black and Green Forums and you'll find it.
Okay. Ryder's trying to cut me off for some reason. It's not really clear why.
No, keep going.
And I think the discussion on there is, while it's still obviously online world, you're happening at a bit more formal, a bit more reasonable, a bit more polite, a bit more serious than other online forums. So I think it is something worth looking at, especially if you're trying to emancipate yourself from Facebook world, but you know you're going to miss having these mediated conversations with all these people that you don't really know in person, but who probably have more in common with you than most of the people within a mile of you.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting because I forgot that I used to be on message boards all the time as a teenager. Like, I haven't been on, I don't think I really used message boards in my 20s. I don't know why. I guess maybe Facebook came and that stopped it or something. But I used to just have all kinds of, like, arguments. I guess it was mostly, like, on banned message boards and stuff like that. But it is interesting to think about the, did message boards die? Did Reddit take over? I don't really know what happened there. The internet is a baffling place to me.
And then finally, for the written form, which I think because of the medium tends toward more thoughtful contemplation, please check out the Black and Green Review. I know some people were bummed out that you have to pay for it as opposed to other publications that are distributed for free, but it is on the cheap side. I think it's $7. Which I think is accessible to a lot of people. A lot of us could spare the $7 to support written anarchist media and stop everything from being sucked into the online world where everyone just wants to yell at each other about how stupid they are or how fucked up they are. And there's still, I think, a lot to be said for the written form. So if you do have $7 or $8, I think, to spare, please consider picking up a magazine, even if you think you're going to disagree with it, even if you end up disagreeing with it. I think it's still good for us to clarify why we think what we think and always be refining our analysis and being challenged. And then, of course, if you do think you're going to agree with it, then why not get the fuck on board and support this publication? I think it really could go places. And, there's one issue out there. I know that in order to keep going, they're counting on a certain number of copies being bought. So please consider picking it up. You can.
So it's more of a book than a magazine. Like, it definitely feels like a book.
Yeah, and so I mean, it's something that you can have on your shelf, refer to, and that kind of thing. It was made to stand the test of time and not just be the kind of flavor of the week. Like, this is what's going on.
Unless I get my wish and more fire happens, then it will not stand the test of time.
Well, I mean, neither would the online world. Then
no, hell no. Nothing Correct. Will stand the test of fire.
The analysis that stops all possibility of analysis. Okay. This is Free Radical Radio. You can find us at freeradicalradio.net. You can email us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net. And we exist on Facebook and Tumblr. All right. Thanks for listening.